Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Senate judiciary hearings begin today for Elena Kagan, President Barack Obama's nominee to replace Justice John Paul Stevens, who is retiring from the United States Supreme Court. And these hearings in recent years have taken on a life of their own. There's usually a lot more chit-chat, however, than there has been. Other stories have sort of captured the attention of the public in recent weeks. The BP oil spill, the deposed General Stanley McChrystal in Afghanistan, for that matter. Probably by last week it would have been reaching a fevered pitch, and that sort of stole the thunder there. Polling, too, affirms all of that most Americans believe Kagan should be confirmed, even though they don't know much about her. 58% of those tested in a June Washington Post ABC poll said that she should be confirmed, including 52% of independents. So we don't know if they're saying that. No one knows if they're saying that because they're too tired to think about, you know, whether she'd be worthy or not and just go with it. Republicans know that in an election year, though, you have to pick your fights. And it's hard to imagine that they want to fight over her. But we'll find out. They aren't going to actually be questioning her today. They're just going to be doing some. What does happen on the first day? Let's invite our guests. We've invited three law professors from the Moritz College of Law at OSU to talk about the process and the pageantry of the process today. Alan Michaels is dean of the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. His specialty is criminal law. He's also clerked at the Supreme Court with Elena Kagan and his friend. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Hi, great to be here.
And Deborah Merritt, clerked for then-judge, now-Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit and for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. Deborah, glad you could be with us.
Thank you.
And we'd like to welcome Edward Foley. He's been the director of election law at Moritz since its conception in 2004. He clerked for Justice Harry Blackmun of the U.S. Supreme Court, and in the spirit of full disclosure, he clerked with Elena Kagan at the D.C. Circuit and is also a friend. Welcome to the show, Ned.
Thank you. Good morning.
So New York Times columnist Gil Collins said that the process, this was the most forthright description I read, that the process of picking a Supreme Court justice has become a joke. and everyone sort of laughs knowingly in a way because it has changed so much over the last 20 years. It doesn't seem like – well, maybe it's me, but it just doesn't seem like people paid quite as much attention to it, and it wasn't quite as divisive as it has become. What's your sense about that, Ned?
Well, I think the Bork nomination in the mid-'80s really changed the national character of these nominations. And Judge Bork had an exemplary resume in terms of academic credentials and so forth. But he was rejected by the Senate as being outside the mainstream in terms of his judicial philosophy and his beliefs. And since then, there's been that question of to what extent ideology or philosophy could affect, the passage from nomination to confirmation.
The mainstream's a moving target, though, right? Whatever that is. How do you determine that in a few 3 days of interviews in a Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, I think the reason that people would say it was a joke is because the safest thing, of course, to do it is to not express your views at all or to express them in the most vanilla way possible. So the incentive is to say as little as possible or as little that could be controversial, and that's the safest way to be mainstream. And so that provokes some of the reactions that you're describing. But overall, I would certainly say I wouldn't agree that it's a joke. The existence of Senate confirmation shapes the presidential appointments substantially. So knowing that the candidate has to go through these rigors certainly affects the president's choice. Whether we think it's for better or for worse, we could argue, but it's certainly
it affects the choice in the first place.
Absolutely.
How do we avoid, though, getting a nominee that is very vanilla? I mean, some people plan their whole lives around getting this far in the legal profession.
Well, I hope nobody plans their life around it because there are only a few vacancies that
will
occur.
Well, Elena Kagan apparently has been, shooting for this for quite a while.
It could well be, but the question is there's maybe thousands of other Elena Kagans mm-hmm. out there who are doing the same thing. I agree very much with Ned and Alan that the Bork hearings had a great impact on what's been happening in the last 20, 30 years. And that people characterize what happened with Bork as him being outside the mainstream. That's what the Senate said. To me, it's a slightly different question that gives real meaning to what goes on in these hearings. It was actually expressed by Justice Scalia a few years ago in a case he wrote involving judicial speech, in which he talked about how people should have preconceptions before they become judges. Otherwise, they would be idiots. How could somebody not have preconceptions?
Live in a vacuum would be right. The only alternative.
But that we're still looking for somebody who is open-minded in the sense that they're willing to consider challenges to their preconceptions when those arise in particular cases.
So how do you get at that personality trait?
I think you get at that in part by relying on the president's discretion in choosing a judge and then also through the Senate confirmation process. We have to remember that there have been nominees who not only have been turned down by the Senate but who've been withdrawn before it came to the final vote in the Senate. So there is a process that goes on there. And I think what people concluded with Bork was that through his answering in the Senate that he showed that kind of closed-mindedness that people didn't want on the court, that there was an important difference between him and, say, Justice Alito or Justice Thomas, who were also equally conservative.
Elena Kagan, we have a clip here about discussing why she thinks she is a good candidate. And this was not in front of reporters or anything. This is a canned interview, but let's listen. We'd have no volume on it. Okay. Here we go.
And do the best I can to decide it in the right way.
Okay. We missed that. We don't know.
I heard decided in the right way, and we're certainly all in favor of that. Just to follow up on Debbie's comment and the significance of these hearings, of course, ultimately when Judge Bork was not approved as a Supreme Court justice, it was Anthony Kennedy who took that seat. And the court's decisions since that time, I think in many cases, have been different because of who ultimately the Senate approved. So it's a serious part of the process.
Absolutely. And I think Debbie's absolutely right also to emphasize this notion of judicial character. It's more important that you come to the bench with that open mind and ability to listen to counsel and to engage the arguments than it is that you're sort of predisposed to be conservative or liberal. I mean, over the years, there are going to be some judges who are more liberal, some more conservative. What really matters to the health of the court as an institution is that willingness to listen, think, grow on the bench. We don't know how Justice Kagan, if she becomes Justice Kagan, will change over the 10, 20, 30 years she might be on the bench. But the character that you bring to that position is what determines that.
My guests are Deborah Merritt, Ned Foley, and Alan Michaels. Alan is the dean of the Moritz College of Law, and Ned and Deborah are professors there. What is it about what Judge Bork was – you're saying when he wasn't as open. He didn't appear as open during the hearings. And I'm trying to figure out what was that very thing, because I was reading an analysis today about, well, how should she act during the hearings? And it's critical that you not act smarter than everybody knows you already are, than the people who are interviewing you.
And many people say that was Bork's mistake, that he not only acted as if he was smarter than everybody else in the room, but acted with a kind of arrogance. And I think it's that arrogance that made people believe that he wouldn't have an openness on the bench, that he not only had preconceptions, but that he was too good to listen to anything else. I don't know if any of that is true of Judge Bork. I don't think I've ever actually been in the same room with him. But that was the view that came across.
Okay, so what about Elena Kagan? What do you know about her? How would she appear before a Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, we'll find out shortly, but I'm projecting rave reviews, so we'll see. But she's been Solicitor General, so she's argued before the Supreme Court, and I'd like to point out that both of my colleagues here have also argued before the Supreme Court, and that requires a facility, a quickness, ability to respond to hostile questions sometimes with equanimity and respect. She's been dean of Harvard Law School, another place where there will be strongly held viewpoints and hostile inquiries at times, and by all reports, she handled those with equanimity, good humor, in a way that didn't leave people feeling insulted, but instead listened to and respected. So those are two pieces of track record that would make you think that she'll succeed in her hearings here. And, of course, she went through hearings to become Solicitor General, and those ended very successfully for her.
Any difference? So she has not, however, been a judge, and that's been a huge bone of contention, obviously. It's the first thing they're going to go after.
Yes, but I'm not sure it's going to carry that much weight. There have been other major justices of the U.S. Supreme Court who weren't judges beforehand, including Chief Justice Rehnquist, who is obviously a leading figure in the conservative world. So, you know, it's a talking point, but I don't think it amounts to much.
What is the deal with them picking on who she picks as her heroes? I mean, doesn't everybody sort of have judicial or legal heroes out there? Don't each of you, studied and learned? What is the danger of having a hero?
Well, in the end, I don't think there is going to be any danger, right? What we've seen in these hearings over the years is that both sides scour the record looking for some sort of remark that they can flag. And when we're looking for judicial temperament, it is possible that if you find certain types of remarks spread over a career, that would suggest to you no judicial temperament. Now, saying one has a hero is not going to fall in this category. And I think, you know, during the last month, it's not just that the Gulf oil spill in Afghanistan and everything else have distracted the public. Nobody has been able to find any serious point on which to oppose Elena Kagan. She seems like a very judicious, temperamented person.
We'll take a quick break and then we'll return. Our guests are Deborah Jones Merritt, Edward Foley, Alan Michaels. Alan is the dean of the OSU Moritz College of Law, and Ned and Deborah are professors as well as Alan at the college. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and post your question or comment there. We'll get back to an email when we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Mostly sunny this afternoon once the showers and thunderstorms move through. Currently, it's 77 degrees here in Columbus. Tonight, clearing skies overnight with a low around 63. Tomorrow should be very nice, some sunshine with a high around 79, and even nicer weather on Wednesday, high around 77 with all sunshine. All this week on WOSU 820, it's NPR coverage of the Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. Join Linda Wertheimer at the end of each day for a one-hour summary of the day's proceedings, with thorough analysis from NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. NPR coverage of Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings all this week on WOSU 820 at 7 p.m. And stay tuned for more of the Senate confirmation hearings with All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We just can't stop chatting here during the break. My guests, Deborah Jones Merritt, Ned Foley, and Alan Michaels of the OSU Moritz College of Law. What about the timeline? The president nominated Elena Kagan in May, and she supposedly, or whoever is, that they're expected, if she is approved or confirmed, will be justice by the end of August. Is that enough time to pick somebody to be a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know the exact dates of the process last year when Justice Sotomayor was approved, but I think the timing is pretty similar. And as long as the justice is ready for that first Monday in October, that when the court comes back into session, you know, the court will be at full functioning and work well. The system has been aware that there might be Justice Stevens' retirement, you know, for some time. In fact, he signaled that to the president before he actually stepped down. And today's Justice Stevens' last day at the court. So the Washington has been working on this replacement for years, if not months, if not years, getting ready for this.
And add to that, the president just made another appointment, and so the presidential process of his creating a short list was all the – so internal vetting, at which she was on that short list when Sotomayor was appointed, that internal vetting had already occurred. And her current position is Solicitor General of the United States, so there's no one who's got more attention on the court's docket or more awareness than she does in her current position. And then for that, she went through a Senate confirmation hearing. So in all three of those areas, this is, you know, a short time frame makes sense.
And when she was picked to be Solicitor General, it was with the sense that that might be a stepping stone to the Supreme Court. So those confirmation hearings were, in some sense, a prelude to what's going to start today.
First female Solicitor General as well. Second female to be nominated by Barack Obama. She'll be the fourth. There'll be three at the same time on the court if she is confirmed. And a lot of history going on here. Three makes a set, doesn't it, Deborah?
I think the biggest thing is that there's been so much history in the last 30 years that it's no longer as significant that she is a woman. That's actually what Justice Ginsburg said many years ago, that what will matter is when we no longer have big headlines about first woman, second woman. With Kagan, it's come down to, well, she's unmarried woman. And what does that mean? Does it mean you can't have children and make it to the Supreme Court? But it's no longer such big news to have a woman nominated.
And that's good.
That's the news.
That's the point. We have an email from Doug. Could the guests discuss opposition from the left for Elena Kagan's nomination? For example, University of Illinois law professor Francis Boyle and constitutional lawyer and Salon blogger Glenn Greenwald oppose her nomination to the Supreme Court. And that has been an interesting facet of all of this. Good, bad?
It's hard to know exactly what to read into that. Some of the opposition has come from the civil rights communities. There's a sense that she wasn't sufficiently attentive to the hiring of minority professors when she was dean at Harvard. She was more interested in hiring conservative professors to have ideological balance at Harvard than traditional diversity characteristics, perhaps. One of her judicial heroes was her boss, Thurgood Marshall, who was the leader of the NAACP and the hero of the civil rights movement. So, you know, my guess is that her track record on the court will be one that the civil rights community will be comfortable with. She may not be the most liberal justice ever. She may end up being that moderate justice. There is an uncertainty there about just how moderate or liberal she'll be.
Well, if she were moderate, she would better reflect the person who's nominating her in the first place. He isn't exactly, no matter what. I mean, when you look at policy, it would more reflect. It would be different otherwise than what the president puts out there in policy.
I agree with you. There are critics of her from the left. I think Ned is right to say that she won't be the most liberal justice in the history of the Supreme Court and is something going to be more moderate than Justice Stevens, who was also not the most liberal justice in the history of the Supreme Court. And I think ideology does matter. There's nothing inappropriate about people raising issues when there's some disagreement with their ideology. It's not surprising. I don't think those attacks from the left are going to undermine her success, though.
The thing I love about the left, and I say this quite genuinely as a leftist, is that it is so fragmented that the left will always criticize anything. There's going to be somebody on the left. There were more critics of Justice Ginsburg from the left than I've heard of Kagan. And so, I mean, Ginsburg was the person who had led the fight for women's equality. She had worked on an amicus brief in the Bakke case.
She was out there.
She was quite left. But there was a very serious attack on her from people who thought she wasn't sufficiently committed to Roe against Wade. So I think that there will always be attacks from either side, perhaps, but particularly the left, which tends to be, I think, nicely fragmented, not having all
in
one
a good
view.
Way.
In a good way.
What are the issues? Ned, you mentioned earlier to me today that there's going to be some decisions coming out of the court today that could arise during the judiciary hearings. What are they? What are they going to talk about from there?
Well, one case from today that's a big one involves gun rights. many people may remember a couple of years ago, there was the so-called Heller case involving the Second Amendment. This is a new case from the city of Chicago that basically asked the question whether that first precedent applies nationwide to all cities, all localities around the country. The court today essentially said yes by a 5-4 vote. So the ruling is important, and because it's an issue of guns and the Second Amendment is likely to come up in Congress, we're just now reading the opinion. It just arrived, but it looks to be an important statement about the sort of structure, overall structure of the Constitution and the relationship between rights and state government and federal governments. So there'll be a lot to kind of read into that opinion about overall judicial philosophy. So I think she'll be – rather than asking her, how would you have decided this particular case, which the Senate can't do, they might use that opinion and say, do you subscribe to this general philosophy of decision-making on the court?
Why can't they ask, how would you decide on a case like that? Why is that? I mean, you could have the same – you could lay out a judicial opinion just as you would in the published opinion.
That's the – essence of our American judicial culture, that judges do not announce in advance how they would decide a particular case. In fact, I think that's the other role of these confirmation hearings. Although they seem like a pageant sometimes, it's a pageant that has a purpose. It reminds everybody what the culture of judicial philosophy is in the United States. The very fact that people will try to ask the nominee, how would you decide this case? And the nominee will say, it would be inappropriate for me to decide that case without the record before me, is a reminder to the judges themselves as well as to the public what judicial decision-making is all about.
We have an email from Carl. The topic of Elena Kagan's sexual orientation has come up. Carl asks whether that would have anything to do with her being affirmed to the Supreme Court. That's one of those things that's sort of on the periphery, but everyone's kind of hinting at it. You mentioned, you know, earlier she's no children, that kind of a thing. What does that? How does that play out in this process now? That issue.
It's unfortunate because it shouldn't even be there, in my opinion. There's nothing. I know nothing about her private life. I don't know why I should know anything about her private life. She is a very upstanding person. There's no evidence that she's ever engaged in any criminal behavior, which is the only thing I want to know about her private life. So I'm glad that issue has actually dropped out. It seems it's been about 2 weeks since I've heard anything about
it. It's still out there.
Still out there.
Yeah, but I think I'll be curious to see if anybody actually brings it up in the hearings.
Yeah, I hope not, and I think maybe not. And I think if we look at we have a blogosphere now that we didn't have 10, 20 years ago, so the volume of rumor and the ability to pass it on is so much greater. But I think especially when we remember that context and imagine a single woman being appointed to the court 10, 20 years ago, I think it would have been a lot worse. Maybe I'm adopting rose-colored glasses.
Well, the mainstream has shifted.
I think so.
I guess would be the case in that and probably a lot of other stuff.
I think you're right, Alan, in that 20 or 30 years ago, the blogosphere, if it had existed, would be asking, has she ever had a boyfriend? Did she ever sleep with anybody?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Exactly. Like Miss America or something, speaking of pageants. Right. When you all were making recommendations as a clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court or in the circuit, were you ever conscious of how those memos might be viewed later on?
I never thought about that.
I don't think so. You just were trying to do the right thing for your boss is what I remember.
Yeah, I thought about it a couple of years later. There was one time where I was a little flip in a memo, but not in what you were saying. But I remember one time where I used a tone that was just sort of, inside baseball, just joking around as we all do in our offices, using a tone that I thought, oh, you know what? If the justice's papers become public, that isn't the kind of tone I would want to reflect. But I think in terms of thinking about your future and the substance, I think all the clerks, at least in my experience, were driven by helping their boss make the decisions he or she wanted to make.
in this age where everything's a public record, obviously, or it should be, but there's so many other records. There's Twitters, there's Facebook, there's all kinds of stuff now. Not emails sort of passe at this point. Is it getting to be ridiculous? Because the way they pull things out from the 1980s, and it makes you wonder, who cares what sort of advice she gave somebody 25 years ago when she was just doing her job?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess one could imagine ridiculous advice that you would care about. But for the most part, I don't think those things will have much traction. And when you say 25 years ago, it is funny to think the year she was clerking on the court was the year of the Bork nomination. And Justice Kennedy came on the court that year. So Kennedy, Scalia, they were justices when she was a kid wet behind the ears, so to speak. And now she's one step away from being their colleague. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think we should be careful to make sure that our standards apply to whoever the nominee, whatever the circumstances. So I'm not sure I would say that a recommendation of a clerk to a boss would never matter. For example, when Rehnquist was a nominee, it turned out that he had clerked way back when during Brown versus Board of Education. And there was some evidence in the record that he supported maintaining segregated schools and not overruling the Plessy case. Now, he deflected that by saying he was reflecting the views of his boss at the time, that that wasn't his own personal views. And it obviously didn't derail his nomination. But I don't think it was inappropriate for the Senate to inquire into that. By the time he was nominated to be a justice, Brown was, you know, the major decision. So it was important to know how the new nominee, Rehnquist, thought about Brown. And he could have also said, yes, that was my view back in 1954. It's now changed. I accept. He had a number of different things he could have said. Mm-hmm. But his role as a clerk was relevant, I think.
We're talking about the Senate Judiciary hearings that are set to begin today for Elena Kagan, President Barack Obama's nominee to replace Justice John Paul Stevens, who's retiring from the U.S. Supreme Court. Our guests, Deborah Jones Merritt, Edward Foley, and Alan Michaels of the OSU Moritz College of Law. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We welcome your calls and emails on this important event, which has been somewhat eclipsed in recent weeks by other equally, I suppose, pressing topics. What does the confirmation process tell us about? Well, the late Tom Moyers from the Ohio Supreme Court, what he wanted to leave as his legacy was changing how judges are selected. Appointment versus appointment and nomination process versus election and that sort of a thing. How does the process and how it's evolving or devolving over the years, depending on your point of view, affect whether that's worth talking about? Deborah?
I think this is a good opportunity for people in states like Ohio who select we select all of our judges by election, mm-hmm. and that's true in many other states, to think about the difference between the processes. There might be a first inclination to say, well, this nomination process and this confirmation is such a pageant and it's so meaningless that shows that we should have elected judges. I would argue the opposite, that what we take again from this confirmation process is this idea of how we reinforce what a judicial temperament is in the United States, and the idea that the culture of judging here is that we decide based upon the evidence brought in the record and the arguments made by counsel, and that inevitably one's own preconceptions play a role in that, but it shouldn't be something where you're playing to the electorate, and that when we're electing judges, we have a great danger of people doing exactly the kinds of things that we're trying to stop from doing in the Kagan case. How would you decide this case? How do you feel about coal companies? How do you feel about criminal defendants? So I would use this opportunity to reflect on that.
I mean, one of the tensions in the American legal system is how much the law can be independent from politics. It can never be completely independent. But there is the goal that the rule of law does mean judges decide cases according to the law and the evidence and not to their own personal political predilections. An appointed judiciary is more likely to be able to withstand political pressure than an elected judiciary. And one of the great truths about Tom Moyer was that he recognized that even though he was the product of the elected system. So I think Debbie is right that we should recognize the virtue of having appointed judges, and that is still consistent with democracy because you want the rule of law in a democratic country.
Alan?
Well,
Sam?
I have nothing to add on that point.
What about limiting their terms on the court? They do by age in Ohio. What about limiting it to, say, 12 or 16 years or however?
Yeah, for the first time in a long time, there's sort of a serious academic petition among, you know, law professors around the country that's proposing that. You know, it would have to be a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution, very, very hard. You need three-fourths of the states to ratify something that two-thirds of both the House and the Senate have adopted. So I think it's unlikely, very unlikely to happen, something to think about intellectually. But
well, it's interesting because if you think about when it was written up in the first place, people didn't live as long as they do now. They just didn't. And you could be – someone said today, although I think this is a gross exaggeration, that she could be on the court for another 40 or 50 years, which is absurd. She's 50 years old now, but she could. I mean, we just lost Senator Byrd from West Virginia. He's 92 years old. Now
I think the open-ended nature of the term is another important part of the judicial process. The appointment is more important, but one of the greatest powers of legal thinking – in my opinion, is the fact that it leads us places we didn't originally know we were going to go. So you had people in the United States starting out saying all men are created equal. And then at some point somebody said, well, we were only talking about white men. Why are we making this race distinction? And then at some point somebody says, if all men are equal, why not all women as well? And so we're led places by this type of legal thinking that we don't know we're going. And that's what I think happens with individual justices. Justice Stevens was far different when he was appointed to the bench than he is today. Justice Blackmun may have been one who made the greatest changes over his life on the bench. And I think there's something, and it's not just the fact that you're there for a long time so you can make those changes, but the very open-ended nature of it makes it possible for you to really reflect on the law. And that's what we want justices to do.
Two things that I would think about in this regard, again, I'm not sure how practical these thoughts are, but one is the one aspect of the open-ended part that troubles me, I generally agree with Debbie, is that justices can choose when they leave. And so we've seen this pattern of justices leaving during the time of a president who they tend to agree with philosophically.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't favor a 12-year term, but some people have talked about 20-year fixed terms or eight, you know, really long terms to give something of what Debbie was talking about, but that you can't choose the year of your time. Of course, you could leave early, so it's not a perfect
solution.
Ultimately,
right? Yeah.
The other idea that I sometimes talk to my students about is whether the framers should have adopted a two-thirds confirmation vote requirement. You know, they picked two-thirds for treaties. They said two-thirds of the Senate have to approve treaties. Not for the – they didn't quite envision the role that the court would take on. There would be downsides to that. For one thing – but pluses. For one thing, the filibuster wouldn't be an issue anymore about whether you use it or not. It would just be a straight – you have to get two-thirds as the constitutional rule. It would tend to force more moderate – you know, the whichever president was in office would have to choose a nominee that would appeal to two-thirds of the senators. Again, I'm not really advocating it, but it's a thought experiment to think about what would be the difference if you had just that different rule for the confirmation process.
We have to take another break. Our guests, Deborah Merritt, Ned Foley, and Alan Michaels of the OSU Moritz College of Law, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, state budgets in crisis. Out of money, running out of time, painful cuts ahead, maybe tax hikes. We'll check in around the country. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
All
On Point is coming up today at 1 here on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's just about 20 minutes past, to noon, I should say. Morning showers and thunderstorms today. Late afternoon, we should expect some sunshine and a high around 85. Currently, it's 77 degrees here in Columbus and cloudy skies. Tonight, clearing with a low of 62, and overnight, we should enjoy some very clear skies leading into tomorrow, some sunshine with a high around 78. And of course, Wednesday, we should enjoy some very nice weather, sunny with a high near 77. Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features more than 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories with their own videos and photos and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this project or learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org. Now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are speaking with Deborah Merritt, Ned Foley, and Alan Michaels of the OSU Moritz College of Law, all three professors there. We're talking about the Senate judiciary hearings that are set to begin today for Elena Kagan, President Barack Obama's nominee, to replace Justice John Paul Stevens. He's retiring from the U.S. Supreme Court. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for our guest. Rod, you're on the show. Welcome. Hi, Rod.
And good morning. And I wanted to bring up one of the criticisms that's been coming from the conservative side has been, the justices have been, the liberal justices have been too activist in the recent time. And that's one of the criticisms they've been leveling at Elena Kagan or some of the recent nominees. And I wanted to, bring up, what do they consider judicial activism, or what is judicial activism? And also I would point out, in the Rehnquist court, they decided that corporations had a right of free speech and so forth, and also the recent decision by the judge in New Orleans overturning the moratorium on drilling, if that isn't activist, I don't know what is.
So what is an activist anyways?
Well, it's a really good question because the sort of traditional definition is an activist judge is one that interprets the Constitution to overturn the decisions of elected democratic branches of government, Congress, state legislatures, governors, presidents. But it turns out that conservatives and liberals sometimes want activist judges and sometimes don't. And we're moving into an era where actually conservatives seem to want judges to intervene more. We see this, for example, on the Obama health care plan. The big lawsuit that's pending now in the trial court is asking judges to strike down the plan that Congress just adopted after this huge national debate that was a democratic process, might have been messy, might have been a result you didn't like, but it was democracy in action. So conservatives have gone to the court to say, no, unconstitutional, strike it down. So if the judges agreed, that might be considered activism, but it's not activism from the left. It would be activism from the right.
Does that help, Rod?
That helps, yes. I want to thank you very much for your time and everything.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. What sort of impact might someone like Elena Kagan have on a court?
Well, I think it'll take some time to tell. Right now, on the 5-4 cases, the cases where one vote can matter, most of the time the more conservative wing has the 5 votes, and most of the time it's Justice Kennedy that's the swing vote. And I would be surprised if on the overwhelming majority of those 5-4 cases where it was the 5 more conservative justices and the 4 on the other side, that she would vote differently from the way Justice Stevens did. So and they would actually need to have Kennedy over on the liberal side and then lose her for her to affect the outcome. So in that obvious ideological sense, we won't know. But as I think you were pointing out earlier, she's going to be on the court maybe in 2040. There are issues that the court's going to be facing that we can't even anticipate at this stage. And over the course of a career, someone of her intellect, her current youth, and her demonstrated consensus-building skills could have a very large impact. Justice Stevens, who she's replacing, for a long time in his career, I think, was viewed as a very, very intelligent jurist, but having surprisingly little impact. He saw things his own kind of quixotic way and would not join the majority or the dissent and was just off there on his own. But in the later years of his career, was seen as a very important leader on a number of issues. So it really takes a long time to know the answer to that question, even though I think it's a very important question.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you're interested in the topic of who's going to be our next justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, we know that the NRA and Planned Parenthood and all kinds of special interest groups out there are, you know, lobbying with bated breath, watching with bated breath. But I was wondering sort of about the larger academic legal community. Is this and whether this is like the World Cup or the Super Bowl or what's it like? Or are you all waiting? And I wonder, too, about the establishment in Washington and in the court itself. Do they sit and jibber jabber about this all the time or what?
I don't think so. This really takes me back, you know, 29 years ago, I had been selected to clerk for Justice Stewart, Potter Stewart, and he announced his resignation on the last day of the term. And there was a period then when I was inside this, and Justice O'Connor took his place. And I was actually in the Supreme Court building that summer. Those of us who would have clerked for Stewart were hired by the Chief Justice to kind of sit out the summer and wait to see if we could clerk for the new justice. And so we watched it from inside the building. And what struck me was that the Supreme Court really doesn't even have a process for bringing on a new justice, that nothing was – during that summer, everybody just waited to see what would happen.
There were no preparations of any
– The only preparation was at that time all of the justices' chambers had little brass plaques that said Mr. Justice so-and-so. And there was a great deal of discussion about what will we do? Will we say Mrs. Justice or Ms. Justice? And the resolution was to take down all the plaques and replace them with ones that just said justice. But other than that, it was really quite mind-boggling in September when she came on the court that we had to start a chambers from nothing, you know, almost no furniture, no pencils, no briefs in there. And so I think the courts are inherently reactive. Right? That's what they do. They decide cases that come before them. So I'm sure that the justices, when they were eating lunch among themselves, were chattering somewhat about what it would be like to have a woman on the court. But it's still a very quiet, hallowed air. The nominee never sets foot in the building. I think they're just – the rest of Washington is buzzing, but they're probably just getting ready to leave for their summer trips. And
Yeah, they probably are in that way. Now, I was clerk, as I said, the year of the Bork hearings, and we didn't have the internet and so forth back then. So I can remember all the law clerks together sitting around a little black and white TV, you know, cheering and booing depending on their viewpoints with each question. And then when the Bork nomination went down, we were waiting to see who it would be instead. And at first was Doug Ginsburg, a D.C. Circuit judge, and then Justice Kennedy. And there were some during the Reagan presidency, there were some conservative clerks who had connections in the Reagan White House, and each morning they'd come in to us and say, oh, you know, it's going to be X. It's going to – in the next day, oh, no, X is out. It's going to be Y. You know, the same kind of inside gossip that turned out to be, you know, clueless as you'd get anywhere else. But it was a focus of gossip among the clerks.
It has to be always exciting when you're going to have a new justice on the court, though.
Well, for, I think, Ned and I in particular, who know Elena and clerked with Elena, to have someone, an old friend really, possibly be on the court, is exciting.
Yeah, when I invited you on, I didn't know that you were friends of hers. For all you listeners out there, but it is interesting. What is she like on a personal level?
Well, I guess I would say she has grown already. I remember her. I clerked with her when we were right out of law school. It was sort of our first jobs after graduating from law school. My first impression of her was she was incredibly smart. I mean, she already had a reputation coming from Harvard Law School as being, really super, super smart. But she was pretty meek and shy, at least initially, was my, impression. But then when you got to know her, she wasn't. And I, picking up on Alan's point about her role as dean at Harvard, she's really grown in many, many ways over the years. She's not the same person today mm-hmm. that she was, decades ago. And she's grown for the better, I would say. And she has this wonderful sense of humor and a soft touch. And so, to me, watching the trajectory over the last couple of decades suggests what Debbie is talking about, the possibility for quite an interesting trajectory over the next couple of decades. She's a person, yes, there are a lot of Elena Kagans out there, a lot of people that could have been nominated. But I don't think it's, in some sense, any accident that she was chose. I mean, she was looked at on that short list. She survived the initial interview last time. She was picked this time. She has met in an impressive way the different career challenges that have come before her. She's, she was in the Clinton White House. That's a setting where if you can't handle a lot of things, you'll leave and you'll go back to private practice or you'll do something different. Each challenge she's faced, she's met and mastered. And that's sort of exciting to watch somebody who may, in the legal profession, sort of the ultimate challenge. So if she gets this opportunity, it'll be fun to watch her sort of meet and master this challenge as well.
Yeah, on a personal level, I think she's has a self-deprecating sense of humor and really is successful in making people comfortable. She went to Harvard as a visiting professor and then within a couple of years was appointed dean. And, Harvard probably tends to think of, only Harvard people can lead Harvard. I mean, it has that. I have my undergraduate degree from there, so I feel comfortable accusing them of a certain elitism. And I think it's really hard to come into that environment and win people over to ask them to be selected as their leader. And she has that make you comfortable, not condescend to you, self-deprecating sense of humor. She was here in Columbus recently just before she was nominated for the Sixth Circuit Judicial Conference. And they were talking about she was on a panel about the court's docket from the past term. And one of the former solicitor generals who was on the panel was complimenting her on her argument. And she said, "Yeah, but I lost the case." That's Elena. She punctured any possible pompousness of the compliment that was coming her way.
When it came to her views, did you find her cautious, her personal views on issues?
I did not see any evidence that she let her personal views intrude in her role as a clerk. There were other clerks in the building who I thought were more aggressive in trying, to kind of push their boss maybe to what they believed. I didn't see that. One has to remember, if you work for one judge and Elena works for a different judge, you're not in direct contact all the time. So you have something of an indirect understanding of their relationship with their own boss. But depending upon the particular case and the issue, you might get some sense of that. Alan clerked with her at the Supreme Court level, where there might be more room for that than at the circuit level where I did. But there were other people that I thought were more aggressive as clerks. She didn't strike me as an aggressive clerk.
I just wanted to follow up on the personal side. I only met Elena Kagan once, but I think it really bears out what both Alan and Ned have said. I happened last fall to argue a case before the Supreme Court, and Elena Kagan as SG was arguing the same morning. She argued the first case from 10 to 11, and then I argued the second. And so after I finished arguing, she came over to me. She hadn't been arguing against me. There was a deputy SG who argued a little bit of my argument. But here's the Solicitor General of the United States in a totally different case comes across the courtroom to me to congratulate me on my argument. I thought – and she was very genuine, you know, the opposite of what you would think of anybody who's arrogant, which the Supreme Court – you know, being arguing in the Supreme Court could make anyone feel a little arrogant. But what the kind of comment she made apparently last month is just what I saw from that one interaction with her.
What do you think the committee members need to ask her, need to know about her, or need to know about any candidate in this position when it comes to serving on the U.S. Supreme Court?
One thing that I would probe of any nominee is the issue of precedent and the role that precedent plays in the Supreme Court's work, because that's what gives stability to the law over time so that the pendulum doesn't swing too far too fast in any direction. Precedent's not completely sacrosanct. You have to overrule Plessy and Brown and similar situations. But there has probably been over the last few decades a general deterioration of the extent to which precedent matters and kind of tugs at the justices. I would say, you know, the standard current model of a Supreme Court justice is for the most part to think, you know, what do I think is the right answer to this question in front of me? And are there any precedents that kind of stand in my way of doing what I want? And I think the court as an institution would be better reoriented to start with the precedents. To what extent do they constrain the institution? Or to what extent do they need to be modified? It's an orientation. It has to go with judicial character. I would ask questions that try to probe that mindset. You know, where is the role of precedent in your own judicial philosophy versus the text of the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera?
Ellen?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, the thing that's really important to bear in mind for people watching the hearings is that the senators have their own agendas. You know, so what would I ask if I were a senator? If I were a typical senator, I'd ask questions that furthered my own political agenda, starting with reelection. And that's not to blame the senators. That's the system.
That's what
they do. That's how it is. But in an idealized, what would I ask her about? I would try to press her on some of the ideological questions that we honestly don't know much about. Executive power, we haven't discussed today. And I would try to cleverly come up with some ways not to know how she would decide particular cases, but get a sense of her thoughts on executive power, on criminal procedure, on Congress's ability to further rights protected in the Constitution, civil rights, rights for disabilities, rights for women, how much leeway, how much congressional power. These are issues that she's going to have a lot of say in, and I would try to see what I could find out.
We don't have enough time. I'm sorry, Deborah. My guests today, Deborah Jones Merritt, Ned Foley, Alan Michaels, all of the OSU Moritz College of Law. Thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having us.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer, helping people make environmentally friendly choices with Meijer EcoWise laundry care, cleaners, paper products, and more. Meijer EcoWise products help lessen the negative impact on our environment because no effort is too small.